today the life and music of American composer and songwriter Cole Porter.
Times have changed, and we've often rewound the clock since the Puritans got the shock when they landed on Plymouth Rock. If today any shock they should try to stem, instead of landing on Plymouth Rock, Plymouth Rock would land on them. In olden days, a glimpse of stocking was looked on as something shocking, but now God knows anything goes.
Cole Porter was one of the greatest contributors to the Great American Songbook and one of the few Tin Pan Alley composers to have written both lyrics and music for his songs. Joining us to talk about the life and music of Cole Porter is Robert Wyatt, director of music at Highfield Hall. He's also a Steinway Artist Smithsonian Institution lecturer and a specialist in American music. Welcome back.
Thanks, Mindy.
Now, Anything Goes might be his theme song, don't you think?
Absolutely. His life was a long one, and he, you know, burned his candle at both ends, and he was one of the most interesting musicians that I've ever studied. You know, yeah. He was a dilettante, a hedonist. He was a friend of all. He was a snob. He could make you feel wonderful. He could tear you down. He was wealthy. He hobnobbed with the rich and the famous. But he was also, you know, a regular type of person, if that sounds possible.
I know, really. Everything rolled away. Now, he was born in Peru, Indiana, 1891, to a well-to-do family.
Very much so. His grandfather had garnered a huge fortune during the gold rush. J.O. Cole had gone out to, you know, the gold fields in California, and instead of digging, he actually started, you know, tent cities where they would sell supplies, and he made a fortune, came back, and purchased a lot of timberland in Indiana and also down in West Virginia, where they happened to find some coal and some oil at the same time.
Wow.
So by the time Cole Porter was born, you know, his grandfather was worth, I think, $17 or $18 million.
Wow. And in that day, wow, that's a lot of money.
That was a lot of money.
Yeah. And I didn't realize this. His name is, surname's from his mom and his dad, right?
Yeah.
Kate Cole.
Kate Cole, and his father was Samuel Porter. So he took the names of his mother's maiden name and his father's
Cole
last
Porter.
Name, and that's it.
And he began playing piano at the age of six and composing as a teenager.
Uh-huh.
And I guess he also played the violin as a kid, but he really was not as impressed with the violin as he was with the piano.
Well, his mother was a stage mom from the very beginning, and you know she dressed him in very strange clothes, especially for a little Indiana farm boy, and made sure that he, you know, took elocution lessons, horse riding lessons, dancing lessons, and of course music. But it was music that he loved the most, and it was with his mother that he learned to improvise and to make fun of people with, you know, clever lyrics and things like
that. Oh my gosh, I know, his lyrics are amazing. Now, his mother changed his legal birth year from 1891 to 1893. Why?
Well, she wanted to make him even more precocious, so he went to, you know, he was sent off to prep school, much to the dismay of his grandfather, who wanted him to be a country boy and to take over the family fortune. So he went to Worcester Academy when he was 14, and she thought that it would be better if he were a precocious 12-year-old, so she just changed his
age.
Isn't
that funny? And now he also went to Yale, and while at Yale, he wrote something like, what, 300 songs?
Correct.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Yeah. And some of those theme songs, like Eli Yale and Bulldog, are still sung today, so he's still famous there.
Yeah, and was it at Yale where he kind of said, you know, this is it, music is going to be my thing? I mean, when did he really decide that he wasn't going to become a lawyer or something? He was just going to...
Yeah, certainly he was there. At the Worcester Academy, he was, you know, valedictorian. He did very, very well at Yale. He majored in clubs and activities and didn't do well. And his grandfather threatened to pull the plug on the money unless he went to Harvard Law School. So he did, and it lasted a few months before he gave up and went to the music department and then dropped out totally to write some Broadway tunes.
And I think his mom waited a little while before they told the grandfather.
Absolutely, because the grandfather always threatened disinheritance, which in fact did occur. When his grandfather died in 1919, he didn't leave Cole Porter a cent. However, you know, Cole's mother gave him $2 million.
Right. So. And now we're talking about the life and music of Cole Porter. Our toll-free number, if you want to join our conversation this morning, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@wgbh.org. Now, he had all those songs that he wrote at Yale, but his first Broadway production, See America First, was a big flop.
It was. Well, it was a terrible show. You know, I think the reviews that I remember... you know, that this was the worst show in town, so don't see America First. And the other one was, you know, Cole Porter has two choices, either write better music or get out of town. Mm. So it ran for 15 performances and then did close. And Cole Porter packed up and went off to Europe to, quote, fight in the First World War, which he did not do, but he claimed that he did.
So he had some great stories. And, you know, we talked a minute ago, you talked about his clever lyrics. And some of his lyrics were a little bit too risque for radio of the day. They didn't always make it by the censors. And Love for Sale from the New Yorkers is a song about a prostitute and was considered too explicit for radio in 1930.
Absolutely.
But it's gone on to be, you know, one of his big songs.
Yeah, I think it was because that it was banned from radio that Cole Porter called this his favorite song. It was his stepchild song. And originally it was written for a white hooker, Catherine Crawford, to be singing outside of Ruben's restaurant in East 58th with three other women of the night. And they realized, even in Broadway, that it wasn't good to have white hookers. So they changed the role and gave it to a black singer. And she was supposedly singing in the Cotton Club in Harlem on Lenox Avenue. Mm-hmm.
And, of course, Billie Holiday also recorded the song. We're going to take a little listen to Billie Holiday's version, a little bit of it then, Love for Sale.
Love for sale, appetizing young love for sale, love that's fresh and still unspoiled, love that's only slightly soiled, love for sale.
I love Billie Holiday. How can you not love her? She's so wonderful.
Well, you know, Cole Porter wouldn't have loved her. He did hear her, but she was a crooner, and he liked his tunes to be sung crisply.
Yeah. He was very particular about that, wasn't he?
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, the score was written for a certain reason, and he wanted the singers to stay with it, both rhythmically, pitch-wise. And, you know, Billie Holiday had her own style. She was a jazz singer, but Cole Porter was not a jazz composer.
Right.
You know, he was a popular music writer.
And later on, with some of the, you know, as we mentioned, some songs that didn't make it past the censors, he changed the lyrics to some of his songs, right?
Yes.
So that they would be able to be played.
Yeah.
And some of them we can't even say on the air. They weren't very good. I mean, they might be, I shouldn't say good lyrics, but they weren't, they were lyrics that might upset some people.
Well, we have to remember that these were also the days, Mindy, where, you know, like in film, a husband and a wife had to sleep in separate beds,
right.
You know, fully clad in, you know, plaid pajamas with nightgowns and overcoats and things over them. So it's a different era.
And let me ask about the censors, because I didn't realize this, but you were telling me before we went on the air that the censors, it wasn't just, you know, national censors, but you could, from town to town or city to city, the censors could change, just, you know, have different decisions on what could make it on the air and what couldn't.
Exactly. In fact, Boston was one of the hardest to clear. So they might decide that a dance in Can-Can, the costumes were a little bit too risque. So they would say, well, before you open, you have to clothe this dancer, or you have to take out that leap or that seductive pas de deux.
Oh, wow. Interesting. He was married to Linda Lee Thomas for 34 years, but some believe that he was homosexual.
Well, there was no doubt. He was not bisexual. He was homosexual. And the only accounts that we have of his bisexuality came from him. Mm-hmm. But in some ways, it made it much easier for the relationship because there was no competition. Mm-hmm. In fact, his lovers, his long-term lovers, he wanted them to have close relationships with Linda because, I mean, he and Linda were an amazing couple. I mean, they truly loved each other. They supported each other. They certainly had their moments, and they almost divorced in 1937 for some reasons that maybe we'll talk about. But, you know, they were devoted. Mm-hmm. And the sexual part certainly got complicated when he came out of the closet, you know, in Hollywood.
Right. So initially, their marriage initially was like a contract. I mean, to keep her social status, and of course, it would be easier for him in the day to have a wife. Was that the basis of the beginning of their marriage?
Absolutely, they were called white marriages. Mm-hmm. Danny Kaye had the same arrangement. Mm-hmm. You know, they were homosexual men who were married to, you know, prominent women, and some people, you know, they did not understand that Cole Porter was a homosexual. Mm-hmm. They also, you know, it was bad for business. Mm-hmm. That's why I think Linda was a little worried about, you know, some of his promiscuity coming to light. It would affect the sales of his tunes.
Right. We're talking about the life and music of Cole Porter with Robert Wyatt, director of music at Highfield Hall. Our toll-free number is 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. There's my favorite song here. I think maybe some other people will agree with me. We have a piece from A Gay Divorcee from 1932, which was Fred Astaire's last stage show.
Yes.
And Night and Day went on to become one of Cole Porter's best known songs.
Absolutely.
And I have to say, I wish we had time to play the whole thing, but we don't. But we'll hear a little bit of it anyway. And Fred Astaire does such a good job with this.
It's perfect.
Like the beat, beat, beat of the tom-tom when the jungle shadows fall. Like the tick, tick, tock of the stately clock as it stands against the wall. Like the drip, drip, drip of the raindrops when the summer shower is through. So a voice within me keeps repeating you, 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 night and day. You are the one, only you beneath the moon and under the sun. Whether near to me or far, it's no matter, darling, where you are.
I just want to swoon. I just love that song. I'm not alone.
Yeah, it's on the ASCAP top 10 list, you know, along with Over the Rainbow and Stardust. It made a lot of money for Cole Porter,
yeah.
But it almost didn't happen because, Fred Astaire had just split up with his sister Adele, who had married a British, you know, lord, and they were no longer a duo. And this was his first solo gig,
right.
And he didn't think that he could sing this song. Number one, it was a long song,
right?
And it also had a high range; it's an octave plus a fourth. So it really it was written specifically for Fred Astaire's voice, but Fred didn't think that he could sing it.
Yeah, well, he did.
He did. It's also one of the only songs that Cole Porter wrote the music first. He usually wrote the lyrics first and then crafted melody around it. But this one, he had the tune in his head and then he added the lyrics.
And what
later.
A marvelous tune it is!
Yeah.
Let's talk to Anne, who's giving us a call from Brewster. Hi, Anne.
Hi, how are you? I wanted to add a little something unique to this conversation. The very renowned Indian mystic Meher Baba, before he died, requested that at his interment that Begin the Begin was played over and over and over. Hmm. And this was in Ahmednagar, India.
Wow.
So the extent to which Cole Porter's music, especially that tune, had an influence is, I think, profound.
Yeah. Anne, thanks for calling and sharing that with us.
I
had no idea.
Story.
Did you know that?
No, that's great.
Anne, thank you.
It so happens that the interment is celebrated tomorrow, the 31st January. So it's very timely you had the show.
I was going to say, I would love to say I knew that, but I didn't. Thanks, Anne, for the phone call.
You're welcome.
Appreciate
Bye-bye.
That.
Thank
Bye-bye.
You.
Susan's calling from Falmouth. Hi, Susan.
Hello. It's a fascinating conversation. I wanted to know Robert's opinion of the movie that came out a few years ago, how accurate it was, especially in the musical presentation.
Oh, it's a very accurate movie. I mean, they held back on a few things, but, you know, the movie Night and Day, which is, quote, the official story of Cole Porter's life, which was done by Warner Brothers back in the 50s, starring Cary Grant, it was a sham. It was definitely fiction. It made Cole Porter look, you know, tall and handsome. You know, Cole Porter was only 5'6", and Cary Grant 6'2". It also made him very heterosexual. Everyone knew at the time that it was a sham. Mm-hmm. But, you know, De Lovely was a really great movie. I enjoyed it a lot.
Yeah. I thought so.
Yeah.
and I thought the portrayal of Cole himself was excellent. And a second question, are there many composers that were as adept as Cole Porter at writing both music and lyrics?
Well, you talk about Irving Berlin, and there was another guy who did it really well. You know, Frank Lesser, Guys and Dolls, Meredith Wilson, and of course, you know, Stephen Sondheim now. But, you know, back in those days, Susan, it was really Cole Porter and Irving Berlin who had the market on that. You know, yeah. The rest were songwriting teams.
Susan, thanks for the questions. I appreciate that.
Well, thanks for the conversation.
Sure. You're welcome. We're talking about the life and music of Cole Porter with Robert Wyatt. And our toll-free number is 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. You know, we talk about, a few minutes ago, we heard Billie Holiday, and you said that Billie Holiday probably wouldn't be Cole Porter's choice because she was more of a crooner. He liked his lyrics crisp. And I guess Ethel Merman turned out to be, she was one of his favorites, right?
She was his favorite.
Absolute favorite.
One for him.
Yeah. And why was that, do you think?
Well, she was crisp. She knew how to deliver a song, and it was mainly her energy. Her energy on stage was unmatched at that time. And they loved each other.
Yeah.
They truly loved each other.
And we'll hear a little of Ethel's energy.
I get no kick from champagne. Mere alcohol doesn't thrill me at all. So tell me, why should it be true that I get a kick out of you?
Okay, you're dancing in your seat here. Now, here's one where lyrics were changed, right? In this song?
Yeah. You know, if we were still listening, you know, she would sing, you know, some people, you know the get a kick from cocaine.
Yeah.
So it was the very first and perhaps the only time during that era where a drug was mentioned in a song title.
That's right.
There was also another little problem, you know, when the song had been written, there was a line in this song that says, I wouldn't care for those nights in the air that the fair Mrs. Lindbergh went through. But before the show came up, you know, the Lindbergh child was kidnapped and murdered. So Cole Porter changed those lyrics immediately for flying too high with some guy in the sky is my idea of nothing to do.
Mm.
So in fact, that whole show, Anything Goes, was a disaster in the making because, you know, they had originally written the book and then the USS Murrow Castle, you know, had a fire and 100 people were lost at sea in the New Jersey coast. And the whole original book of Anything Goes was a shipwreck.
Mm-hmm.
And so they couldn't do this. So they changed the whole show in a matter of weeks. And of course, it was one of Cole Porter's two perfect shows, the other one being Kiss Me, Kate.
I was going to ask you, what was the other? And Kate, after his mom?
No, because of a Taming of the Shrew. So
okay. Now, let me ask you this. 1937, he had a riding accident that crushed his legs.
Yeah.
And this was a serious problem for him because he lived in chronic pain for the rest of his life because of that,
absolutely.
Right?
He had, between that time and his death, he had 35 surgeries.
Wow.
Sometimes the pain was so intense that he would pass out. Mm. He became a frequent, not that he wasn't before, but a more frequent drug user and alcohol. But he also exhibited an incredible bravery that was unexpected of him because he was a pampered person.
Right.
But he certainly, you know, endured many, many things. He had to be carried into theaters, but he still, you know, went to the top of the mountains in Peru to see Machu Picchu. He traveled, he went on yachts. I mean, his lifestyle didn't change,
mm-hmm.
but he just, everything shifted. In fact, I think he might have written even his best music after the accident.
That was going to be my question. Here's a guy in chronic pain, and his work still was, you know, his work didn't seem to suffer from it.
Yeah. Well, after his first rehabilitation, 6 or 7 months in the hospital, he had a mechanism set up where they hoisted a piano and lowered it. So because his legs were both out straight in cast, he was in a full body cast. So he had a mechanism where they could actually lower a piano so he could play a piano from his hospital bed.
Wow.
And when Mary Martin first met him, that's what he did. He auditioned her, you know, with this piano.
And now also because of this pain, he also suffered from some depression, severe depression. And yeah. I read that he was one of the first people to experience electric shock therapy.
Yeah, he had quite a few sessions of it
wow.
in the 50s.
Yeah, that's really interesting. We mentioned Mary Martin, and we do have a little clip of Mary Martin. And now, was this song controversial as well, My Heart Belongs
oh,
to
Mary? Oh, yeah. This was another one that couldn't be sung on the radio until they changed the lyrics.
With all those boys who mock refined ladies, but now I tell each young gazelle to go the hell, I mean Hades.
Mary Martin singing My Heart Belongs to Daddy. And this was, now, this was her, did he launch her career? What was the story there?
Yeah, this was, you know, he wrote a really bad show called You Never Know. It was the very first thing that he did after he was, you know, had his accident. And it was therapy. His doctor said, you know, get back to work. And then it failed, and he wrote this show called Leave It to Me. And, you know, Mary Martin was the ingenue role. And, you know, when she auditioned, she came in into this suite where he was, you know, still in bed, and she said, "Listen, I've got four songs, and if you don't want to listen to all four, I'm leaving." So he said, "I'll listen to all four," and he said it was the best audition he had ever heard.
Oh, wow.
But she was a naive girl from Texas, and when she was given this song, she didn't understand what she was singing. And Sophie Tucker was in the same show, and Sophie said, "Listen, you know," she said, "you know, when you get to this part, make sure that you look up at the ceiling and roll your eyes." And she would get a great roar from the audience.
Oh,
but
that is funny.
But Mary Martin said it wasn't until she re-recorded the piece. I mean, she recorded the piece with different lyrics that she realized that those were dirty ones.
Yeah, my goodness. Well, we mentioned Ethel Merman was Cole Porter's favorite, but another singer that he really enjoyed working with was Lena Horne. And how could you not enjoy Lena Horne's voice? I mean, she's got to be one of my favorites as well.
Me too.
And so we're going to hear a little bit of a song, but tell us a little bit of what this is. It's All Right With Me?
It's All Right For Me. It's from Can Can. Now, most people don't know that, you know, Cole Porter's top show was Kiss Me, Kate, but his second longest run was Can Can.
It's the wrong time and the wrong place. Though your face is charming, it's the wrong face. It's not his face, but such a charming face that it's all right with me. It's the wrong song in the wrong style. Though your smile is lovely, it's the wrong smile. It's not his smile, but such a lovely smile that it's all right with me.
All right, Lena Horne singing It's All Right With Me. Talk a little bit about his lyrics, where he got his inspiration for some of these songs that are so popular still today.
Well, Cole Porter was a night owl, and he wrote most of his songs at night. In fact, his apartment in Manhattan in the Waldorf Towers was especially soundproofed, and Linda had her own separate apartment so she wouldn't be disturbed. And you know, he wrote a lot of love songs, and his love songs were actually written for and about his relationships with other men. And this is an example of it, especially, you know, when he was, you know, before his accident, you know, he had men in his life that were long loves. He also had promiscuous love. But, you know, he was ardent in his passion. And he, you know, he wrote many of these songs specifically for his friends.
Now, Porter's last major hit, True Love, he wrote that for High Society, right? For the
yes.
film High Society,
mm-hmm.
Starring Bing Crosby, Frank Sinatra, and Grace Kelly.
Grace Kelly.
Who we're going to hear a little bit of Grace singing as well.
But to give to you and to give to me love forever true. For you a guardian angel with nothing.
Grace Kelly did a pretty good job there.
She did a great job. Well, yeah. She was a brilliant person, and for her to sing was, like Meryl Streep singing. It was something that was part of her role, and she could do it. Yeah. And she did it well.
Now, the latter years of his life, after 1958, Linda died, was it 1957? She died
in 54. His mother died in 52, and then Can-Can came out the next year, and then Linda died.
And after 1958, he spent his remaining years in relative seclusion, right?
Yeah, his leg, both he named his legs, by the way. Oh. Geraldine was the right leg and Josephine was the left leg, and Geraldine was always, he called her the shrew, the bitch, and she was the one who was finally removed in 1958, and for the next 6 years he lived without a leg. He did not compose a song after that, and he said, I'm only a half of man now. And he went into seclusion in his home in Williamstown, Mass, and his apartment in Manhattan, saw very few friends, and basically withered.
He died in 1964.
Mm-hmm.
So that's
in California, he loved California. He lived half of his, once the first movie in 1935, he spent half of his life in California.
Yeah. Now, his work, when you look at how he wrote pretty much, up until those last few years of his life, he really had great success for most of his life.
Yeah, he was one of those songwriters that didn't really have a hit until he was 37 years old.
And then never
stopped. Irving Berlin told him to come back if he wanted to, have a Broadway show. He needed to live at 42nd and Broadway.
We're going to end the show this morning with Cole Porter singing You're the Tops. What's the title of the song, You're the Tops?
You're the Top.
You're the Top. The Top, thank you. And Robert Wyatt, director of music at Highfield Hall. He's also a Steinway artist, Smithsonian Institution lecturer, and specialist in American music. Always fun to have you here.
Thanks, Mindy.
Robert. I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
At words poetic, I'm so pathetic that I always abound at best. Instead of getting them off my chest, to let them rest unexpressed.
The Point is hosted and produced by Mindy Todd. The executive producer is Steve Young. Production assistance from Dan Treidel and Jenny Jenker. The Point is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH Radio.
You're the Colosseum, you're the Top, you're the Louvre Museum, you're a melody from a symphony by Strauss, you're a Bendel bonnet, a Shakespeare sonnet, you're Mickey Mouse, you're the Nile. You're the Tower of Pisa, you're the smile on the Mona Lisa. I'm a worthless check, a total wreck, a flop, but if baby I'm the bottom, you're the top.